Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
If you look up the word blue in a dictionary, you get the sense that the editors are barely trying. Definitions are mostly about how clear daytime skies are blue, or they note where blue lies on the color spectrum visible to humans. But seriously, what words would you use to explain the color blue to someone who had never seen it? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Maybe it's okay that blue is hard to put into words, because really the only way to experience it is to see it. But it's possible we can appreciate it even more if we realize just how unusual it is for living things to appear blue, and what's taking place in our eyes and our brains that allow us to perceive the color at all. Kai Kupferschmidt is a contributing correspondent for Science magazine and author of the book Blue, In Search of Nature's Rarest Color. Kai, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Hi, Chris.
You could probably have focused on any color and made an interesting book. What makes blue special?
Yeah, I guess that's two questions, right? I mean, one is what makes it special for me, which is really just the fact that it is my favorite color. But then again, it is special as a color because it is most people's favorite color. I mean, across cultures, across countries, if you ask men and women, blue tends to be their favorite color. So I remember very well as a kid when I was collecting minerals that the blue ones were always my favorite. And this was also the first one I ever got. And I've just always had this fascination with it. And it was only over time when I started working as a science journalist and stories kept crossing my desk, like research papers in which the color blue played a role. And I kind of realized that there was something about blue that made it still hard to produce and that still kind of threw up a lot of mysteries in science. And in the beginning, I actually thought that maybe it's my personal bias because I like the color. And so I actively looked for papers on other colors. And I realized that there really is something about blue in nature, that there's still a lot of science going on around it. And that's, I think, something that kind of just started me off on this journey.
You spent some time with a chemist named Mas Subramanian who discovered the first new blue pigment in organic chemistry in 200 years. So how did this happen?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story because as so often when it comes, like if you go into the history of these dyes or pigments, it's usually an accident. And that's the same with Mas Subramanian's discovery. So he was working at Oregon State University in Corvallis. And basically, he was trying to do something completely different. He was trying to make a substance that's called a multiferroic. So that's a substance that has certain electronic properties and magnetic properties, and you could be able, for instance, to design a faster computer with it. So that's what he was looking for. And he had this idea to combine these three substances, and that maybe that would get him the substance he wanted. And he combined them, and it just turned out to be incredibly blue. And because he had worked at DuPont years earlier and he had talked to colleagues there who had told him how hard it was to make blue, he kind of realized that that maybe he was onto something. And so he published a research paper on it, he patented it, and that's what, you know, today is Yinmin blue. That's the short form of it because it's made from yttrium, indium, and manganese. So that's why it's Yinmin.
It would seem as if ancient people who found blue rocks, right, like lapis lazuli, could have ground them up and made them into paints, but lapis turned out to be a big disappointment on its own.
Yeah, if you take a lapis stone, I've actually done this, I have to admit, if you take, one of these beautiful stones and to try and grind it up, even if you look at the lapis already, you can see there's blue in there, and then there's the gold, the pyrite, and then there's white. And if you all grind it all up, it basically is just kind of a grayish powder. It's not very blue. And it was only really, in the Middle Ages that people developed this very cumbersome way of grinding up the lapis lazuli, but then washing it and kind of producing it in a way, through several steps. It really took a long time to make it into this beautiful blue powder, which was then known as ultramarine. But when people first tried this, like they didn't find the recipe for this. So ultramarine, that very blue pigment that most people know, is really something that's fairly new. So for instance, Egyptians didn't have access to it.
So how did the Egyptians make blue pigment?
Well, again, I think it must have been an accident. I mean, they did come up with the first with the first synthetic blue pigment, or the first synthetic pigment in general, which is called Egyptian blue now. And it's basically a combination of several things. There's potash in there and sand. And if you bake it in a certain way, you get at first something that's more like a glaze. If you've ever seen, it's often called blue frit. So if you go to an Egyptian museum, you can see these little statuettes sometimes in this kind of blue glazed look. And that was probably the first thing that they came up with. And then over time, they actually refined it and managed to produce it also as a color that you could, you know, use, for instance, on murals. So if you go to Egypt and if you go to some of the old grave sites, you can still see the original Egyptian blue on some of the paintings there in Saqqara and one of the sites where the pharaohs were.
But then the formula that the Egyptians used was lost to history?
That's what it looks like. So people stopped using it at some point, and it looks like the recipe just got lost. There is there's some speculation about, you know, how exactly it was lost. But overall, it's just been very, very difficult to make blue. And that's throughout history, that's just a common theme.
So you explain here that one challenge with making blue from stones or minerals that are blue is that the same elements can reflect and absorb light in very different ways. For example, rubies are red, emeralds are green. They give off radically different colors, but they're both made from chromium. So what's the difference between them?
Yeah, this is something that actually, you know, that really blew my mind when I first realized it, that because they're such kind of strong colors, right? Everybody knows that green and that red. But yeah, so what makes the color, so these minerals, of course, there's kind of a crystal lattice, and then you have certain ions in them, in this case, the chromium ions, and they are the ones that absorb certain amounts of light. So whenever you see a color, it means that there's a certain part of the color spectrum that's being absorbed. And both in the rubies and in the emeralds, it's the chromium ion that absorbs color. But the reason it absorbs a different type of color and then what you see is different is that the other atoms that are kind of arranged around it, they exert an influence on the chromium ion. And so it changes a little bit how much energy is needed to elevate one of its electrons to a higher level. And that's basically how most colors work, right? It's that some of the light, some of the energy that comes with a certain color is basically used to elevate an electron to a higher energy level. And those energy levels, that decides basically what color something will have.
We remember Isaac Newton best as the guy who first understood gravity, but he also made great strides in explaining how light and color work. Why was it such a big leap forward when Newton figured out how to separate sunlight using a prism into all the different colors?
Well, there were just a lot of completely different theories about how colors come about. There was this idea that maybe it's a different type of mixture of light and darkness that gives rise to these different colors. And by showing that white light basically encompasses all of these colors and kind of, you know, showing that you can open that rainbow and you can close it again with a prism, he really explained, you know, he really opened up this whole realm of nature also to exploration. And I think, I mean, I write in the book about this fact that some people, you know, for instance, Keats in his poem criticized Newton for kind of, by explaining the rainbow, kind of making it less mysterious, less interesting, less beautiful. But of course, you know, maybe that's because I'm a science journalist, but I think in general, I mean, once you realize, you know, what goes into a rainbow and how it actually develops, it to me, it makes it more beautiful. And one of the things I realized is, so a rainbow, basically the way that a rainbow comes about is that light is reflected and refracted in a drop of rain, right? And then what happens is that whenever you see a rainbow, if you look really closely, you can usually see another rainbow with inverted colors above it, because that's the light that's been reflected twice in the raindrops. And so you get another rainbow higher up with inverted colors. And it's one of those examples, I think, where when you understand these things, it allows you to see certain things and to realize certain things. And of course, out of what Newton did comes this whole research then of extending the rainbow, really, of realizing, wow, if we open up this white light into the different colors, then actually if we place something, you know, next to the red where there's no color anymore, stuff actually gets heated up there, and that's how infrared was discovered. And then the same, of course, with the other end of the spectrum, where you found ultraviolet light. So it just opens up this whole electromagnetic spectrum that, of course, you know, carries radio waves that we're using now and everything. I mean, that's really the beginning of that.
So our perception of the color blue is like a collaboration between the light reflecting properties of the object itself and our eyes and our brains. First of all, what kind of equipment in our bodies is necessary for us to perceive something as blue?
Yeah, so there's a lot that comes together, but basically, of course, you have the eye, which has, first of all, you know, you need the cells that can actually sense the light and the different colors. And for us to be able to see colors, we have to realize that you need several different receptors. So if you just had one receptor in the eye, you wouldn't be able to tell what color the light is, because the receptor is always going to react to several different wavelengths, and you're never quite sure whether, you know, it's this wavelength and it's very strong, or it's weaker and another wavelength. So humans have three different cones, so three different receptors for three different colors. We usually call them red, green, and blue. And first of all, you need the signals from these light sensing cells. But then, of course, you need quite a lot of equipment in the brain, quite a lot of computing power to take these signals and then calculate from them what wavelength something is. And then, of course, there's this other thing, this much bigger thing that is really hard to explain, which is we don't see wavelengths, right? We see a color. We have a sensation when we see blue. And it's very hard to describe that. And it's more than just, you know, a certain wavelength. I mean, different things look blue to us, even though they have slightly different wavelengths. So there's a lot of computing that goes on in our head that kind of creates this impression of color. And it's really one of the biggest things when I was writing the book was, to me, like this, the fact that we walk around the world every day and we kind of have all of these colors that we see, and we don't realize what an amazing kind of production it really is in our brain to create this technicolor sensation. You know, it's really, really fascinating.
We think about people who are completely blind as functionally unable to perceive information through their eyes, but scientists have discovered there may be other cells in the eye that respond to blue light in particular, even if those individuals can't see that light.
Yeah, this is a very interesting, you know, track of research that's still going on. What we know is that there are some cells in our eyes that aren't really primarily about perceiving light and kind of creating an image, but rather they help, for instance, to to keep our 24-hour cycle of day and night going, to kind of our inner clock. So basically, when you have jet lag, what the problem is partly is getting adjusted to this new cycle of light and day. And it seems that the cells that do this, you know, there are people who don't have the cone cells that actually perceive light for an image, but they do have the cells that can perceive this light. And so you can actually show in experiments that sometimes they can perceive, and usually this is blue light, and they have the pigment that can perceive this blue light, and you can show that they actually subconsciously they perceive it, they can react to it, and they do react to it. For instance, their body clock reacts to it. But there's a lot of research going on this, partly because we are so surrounded now by blue light. One of the things that people don't realize is that electrical light bulbs, for instance, the reason they're so inefficient is that they give off most of their light in the infrared, right? They mostly give off heat and not light. But the same goes for the rest of the color spectrum. So they give off a lot of red light and then a bit of yellow, and then it goes down to very, very low levels of blue light. Now, with the modern LEDs, it's a different situation. You actually have a lot of blue light around you. So there is the question whether this, you know, us being surrounded by all of this blue light, whether this is somehow changing, things about our, for instance, our sleep cycle. And of course, that's why, you know, many mobile phones, for instance, now have these filters for night mode and all of these things. But there's still a lot of research to be done on this. But it is fascinating that we're realizing that there are parts of our, you know, that we do have cells, possibly even in our skin sometimes, that can sense light without actually, you know, without us even thinking about it.
Why do so few plants that have not been crossbred or engineered in some way produce truly blue flowers?
Yeah, this goes back to the, you know, the kind of the conundrum, why is blue so rare in nature? And again, so it's some basic steps, right? It's to produce blue, you need to absorb red light. Red light is the light with kind of the lowest energy. So you need to have a molecule or something that can absorb a tiny amount of energy, and that will be the absorbed red light, and then the rest looks blue. And it just turns out that in nature, to create a molecule that absorbs this red light, it's very hard. You have to make quite large molecules that, you know, with lots of atoms that are linked to each other in a certain way in order to be able to do this. And then it just turns out that in evolution, nature has created all kinds of pigments. I mean, you know, there's betalains, for instance, which turn beetroot red. There's carotenoids, but it's only the anthocyanins that can create blue. The other pigment classes can't even create any blue. And then with anthocyanins, there's only very specific types of it and under very specific circumstances that can be blue. And a lot of plants, a lot of flowers just never kind of hit or it wasn't worth for them to develop this kind of, you know, intricate chemistry in order to appear blue. If you really did dive deep into some of the chemistry of these flowers, it's crazy what they have to do in order to actually appear blue.
What does it take to turn indigo plants into indigo dye? Indigo plants are just green, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they, in modern day, of course, it's all produced synthetically, right? So if you're wearing jeans, that is likely to be, you know, coming from a factory that produces indigo synthetically. But in the past, of course, it was made from different types of plants. There were certain plants that were already being used in Europe in the Middle Ages. And it was a very, very cumbersome process. So you had to actually, you know, take these plants and you had to dry them, and then they were left. Usually you actually had to use urine in order to soak them in it for a really long time.
Ugh.
And all of this was kind of done in order to get to this, you know, chemical at the end, which is glucoindigo, which is a colorless chemical. And then if you put the cloth into a vat full of that, and then you take it out, this amazing thing happens, which is really beautiful to see, which is you take it out and then suddenly in the air it turns blue because the leucoindigo is oxidized into indigo, and that's kind of the blue that you want. And that was for a long time, you know, there were certain parts of the country, for instance, in Germany, in Erfurt, there were people, you know, planting these plants, and those parts of the country grew very rich because this was the only blue available at the time. So it was a very, you know, it really threatened the people who were producing the red dye at the time. So there was this whole kind of fight between the people producing the red dye and the people producing the blue dye. And there were laws made in order to keep the indigo from overseas being imported into Europe. So there's a lot of, you know, it's chemistry in a way, it's botany, but then of course there's a lot of history and business interests involved in it.
What do we know about how the culture we come from might shape the way we perceive blue or any other color?
So, you know, as a journalist, language is so fascinating to me, and I've had a lot of discussions over the years about, you know, how powerful really is language. There's all of these debates always, and the color spectrum is really one of the examples where that has been probably, you know, studied the most and tested the most, because you can very easily compare. I mean, you can take a certain color and show it to people who speak different languages and then ask them what color they actually, what they would call it. And it turns out that different cultures, you know, make different distinctions between in the color spectrum. So they basically have, we have the basic colors that we use in English. And then if you go to a different language, there's many languages that don't distinguish between green and blue, for instance. But then there's also a few languages that actually distinguish blue further. So if you take Russian, there's Goloboy and Sini, which is probably completely butchering these words, but one of them is light blue and one of them is dark blue. And you have the same in Greece, where you have Galatio and Ble. And these are two different hues of blue, but they're basic words to them, like, you know, red, blue, orange, green are to us. And so every kid learns them and you automatically distinguish between them. And then psychologists have gone ahead and have tested, you know, speakers of these different languages to see whether you can, you know, whether that somehow changes your perception. If you grow up always distinguishing light blue and dark blue automatically, does that mean that somehow that changes things? And it turns out that it does. I mean, there's very basic experiments where you can ask people to distinguish, you know, you show them one type of blue, and then below you show them two different blues, and they have to say which one of them corresponds to the top one. And it turns out that if the lower ones, one of them is a light blue and one of them is a dark blue, then people who have different names for these different blues are much faster at distinguishing them, because to them it's clear they're two different colors and they can immediately see, you know, which color the top square is. Just one example. But there's other research that has been done with Russian speakers and with Greek speakers, which shows that there's even certain things that they perceive that we wouldn't be able to perceive. So there's something called an attentional blink, which means that, you know, for a few milliseconds after you've realized something, after you've seen something, you can miss what comes afterwards. So if I show you a lot of different shapes, for instance, one after the other really fast, and I tell you to look out for the triangle, then you'll miss what comes immediately after the triangle, for instance. That's very typical. It's called attentional blink. But it turns out if you do that experiment with German speakers, with English speakers, and you do it with Russian speakers and Greek speakers, and in that attentional blink, so that moment which you normally miss, that thing that we just don't perceive, that we don't see, if you have a contrast there between a light blue and a dark blue, then that contrast is enough for Russian speakers and for Greek speakers to suddenly see this shape that we would just miss because we don't see a contrast there. So the contrast breaks through the attentional blink. And that's just one example where you can really see that, you know, the categories we make in language, the way that we shape the world around us with our language, it does have a bearing on how we perceive things. I mean, these are tiny effects, right? This is not... I don't know whether you've read, Story of Your Life or seen the movie Arrival. I mean, you know, there's this idea that language can completely change your perception of time or things like that. This is not what we're seeing here. These are tiny, tiny effects, but they are there and they're real. And so that's fascinating to me as somebody who uses language. And sometimes I wonder, you know, how different the world looks maybe if you speak a very different language.
All right, Kai, we've already established that the color blue is quite rare in plants. Why are there so few animals with blue body parts?
Well, it turns out that animals can't really produce any blue pigment at all. So, I mean, there's a very few rare exceptions, but when you see blue in animals, it's usually, really a trick of light. So what they do is that they have these tiny structures. So, for instance, if you take a morpho butterfly, this beautiful, you know, shimmering blue butterfly, its scales have these tiny, tiny structures. They're called Christmas tree-like structures. So they're microscopically tiny, and if you go into the nanoscale, you see these structures, which really do look like Christmas trees. And they reflect, so they have several layers, and then the way that they reflect the light, it's done in such a clever way that basically all the other colors end up overlaying each other so that they cancel each other out. And all that's reflected in the end is the blue. And that's more or less how most animal blues are actually made, is through this. So this is called a structural color. It's kind of similar to if you think about if you see some, you know, some oil in a puddle and you see these shimmering colors, that's a structural color. And animals have just basic uses. Or if you take a soap bubble, and animals have basically taken that principle and they've really engineered themselves to manipulate the light so specifically that it only appears blue. But you do get that shimmering that you see there as well. So that's kind of a hint.
Peacock feathers don't look blue if they get wet?
Not under the microscope. Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. You can show that because it depends on the air between the layers. And so you can show that if you kind of make them wet, then the color gets lost and you don't have that beautiful blue shimmering anymore.
It would seem as if a caterpillar would be best protected from predators who eat caterpillars if they could evolve bodies that camouflaged well on tree trunks or soil, which many of them do. But why do some caterpillars avoid being eaten because their bodies look blue?
Right. This is like one of those mysteries that originally drove Charles Darwin a little bit mad. And his friend Alfred Russel Wallace actually came up with a great idea, which we still believe to be true today, which is, you know, that those caterpillars that have, you know, this kind of very, you know, strong and visible color, they must be very unappetizing basically to predators like birds. So either they, you know, have toxins or they taste really badly. And this was actually put to the test by a contemporary of the two. So Wallace basically asked this researcher called Weir whether he could test this in his aviary, because he had birds and he had caterpillars. Yeah, and he found that, you know, he could use some of the most strikingly colored caterpillars. They could just walk around the aviary without ever being picked on by a bird. And then other ones, the ones that were actually quite well camouflaged, they were the ones that the birds would actually go for. And so blue can be, in some cases, a warning color. It's still very kind of, it's hotly debated still in, you know, for different animals, whether it's a warning color or whether it's really, you know, to attract mates. Sometimes it's probably both, but it's definitely, in some cases, it can be a warning color.
The way we perceive color in water is different from the way we perceive color in just about everything else. Isn't that right?
Yeah, water is this very, very rare substance in which the red light is basically absorbed through vibration energy of the water molecules. It's really fairly unique. All the other blues come about in different ways. And if you take a glass of water, you don't really see that it's blue, because the effect is so small. It really takes large bodies of water, you know, in very clear water, in order for it to then appear blue. When I went to visit Ma Subramanian in Corvallis in Oregon, I also went to Crater Lake, which is just a stunning example of what a very, very clear blue body of water, you know, how blue it can really look in the light. And it's really, really beautiful to see. But of course, if you take a bottle of that water, that won't look blue, because it's not enough.
I was fascinated to learn, by the way, that eye color is actually not about some particular set of genetic instructions that program for blue or green or brown eyes per se. It all comes down to how much melanin we have in our irises.
Yeah, that's right. It's a structural color. So this is one example in humans where basically the question is how much of the light that goes into your eye is absorbed and how much is scattered or reflected back. And so if there's a lot of melanin in there and it basically gets absorbed, then the eyes look dark. But then on the other hand, if it's actually a lot of it is reflected, then again, for a similar reason that we see the sky is blue, the eyes are going to look blue, because that's the light that gets most scattered. So you're going to get most of the blue light back, basically.
When you say that blue is a lot of people's favorite color, is that true across different societies, or is it something that is true especially in places like the US and Europe?
So it is. We know it best, of course, for these, you know, for countries like Europe and the US, where a lot of this research has been done. But it has been, you know, people have asked across other cultures and come up with the same conclusion. What I would be really interested in, of course, is how it's been over time. I do wonder, like, there are some people who sometimes suggest that we kind of live in in the age of blue. If you look at, for instance, all the, kind of the social media companies and the online companies, a lot of them are using blue logos, and a lot of other companies are actually even changing their logos to blue. Blue is, in our day and age, associated with a lot of positive things, and it's seen very positively. And I sometimes wonder whether, if you go back in history, whether maybe there was a time when that wasn't the case. But it's very hard to really, you know, to find that out now, of course. But at the moment, it seems to be that really across cultures, it's people's favorite.
Reading this book made me think about art and how different it must have been before artists had access to blue pigment.
Yeah, I mean, really, one of the things that stands out to me, well, you know, after writing the book is that artists are so, you know, bound by what they have available as you know, pigments and dyes, and play such a role. And if you've ever stood in front of an Yves Klein painting, for instance, like I went to Paris to see one, you know, in real life, and there's just an impact that it has in you. Like that color, it's that synthetic ultramarine, but it uses a certain specific binder that really keeps its kind of the pigment of it. And if you look at that, it has such a strong oomph. And that's something, you know, he worked very hard to get to that specific blue, but he needed the synthetic ultramarine to be there for it. And without it, he wouldn't have been able to do this. And that's something, you know, that material part of artists, of art and of what artists can use. I think we sometimes don't appreciate that enough.
So do you find yourself looking at the world differently since writing this book?
You know, I do. And then at the same time, I constantly catch myself like forgetting about it. It's really, you have to remind yourself. It is one of those things, like one of the things after writing the book that I told myself was like, you know, if you ever feel like stuff's not going well, you just look at the sky. Just remember, like, there's so much beauty around you and so much wonder. I just find it amazing. And that still works for me. But of course, you know, like, I've spent the last 1.5 years reporting on COVID-19. And it, you know, there's times when you just don't have, you know, when you just kind of are in this rut and you forget about it. But it is nice to kind of step out of it. And, you know, at the very least, when there's a rainbow out there, you know, enjoy that and look at that and just kind of marvel at it, really.
Kai Kupferschmidt is a contributing correspondent for Science magazine and author of the book Blue, In Search of Nature's Rarest Color. Kai, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Mia Estrada, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.